I hope that this talk is an encouragement to you, especially if there's a huge intimidation factor for you. There's handouts. There we go. Okay. On great books. I like to say, if you think I'm ahead of you on this, then I'm probably a step and a half ahead of you. And these really brainy folks like Ty Fisher, and they're another step or two. And there's 1,000 steps to go. So we can walk together in this one and get to where we need to be maybe in the next generation. So that's all I were to do. But I want to talk to you about great books and using great books in your curriculum. First, we have to figure out what do we mean by great books. And that's pretty hard to define. Sometimes we call them great books. Sometimes we say the Western canon. That's our heritage of literature, and there's a set called the Great Books, the Western World set. Often when people talk about great books, this is what they're talking about. This was a collection that was Mortimer Adler and Hutchins, I can't remember his first name, edited these, put these together, and Britannica sells them. I recommend the set. It's a good set. Goes from Aristotle, I think it's number one, maybe Homer, and if it goes from the Greeks to the moderns, and there's two sets of these. If you're looking for a bargain, there's an older set that doesn't have the 20th century authors in it, and you can get those used for a good price. But so sometimes we define the great books this way. In essence, what we care about when we were talking about the great books is there's a great conversation and a great heritage that our culture has been blessed with. And it started with the Greeks, it started with the Old Testament, and has gone through the whole, just trace the history of the church. You know, the Messiah came to the Hebrew people living in a Roman world. They had that Greek heritage, we have the Roman heritage, we've got medieval Europe, and far on. And so these we call the great books, those who have endured. They're books that have contributed to the great conversation, that great evolution and development of ideas, diversity of ideas, all those centuries. So we have a good model, too, in Scripture with Apostle Paul. Was a learned man who had read the great books that were written up until his time. He had received a classic Greek paideia education as well as a Hebrew education. And he quoted the Greeks with felicity. And we see that in the letters that we have remaining from him. And he was able to make the argument because he knew the ideas. He knew that, and you see how well laid out the epistles are and how the arguments develop, how objections are answered. He has learned, he's used his learning in this way to be the great apostle to the Gentile nations. So it is also is necessary for our kids to be able to understand the old ideas in their modern form. You know, Ty mentioned in his plenary talk Arius and the Arian ideas that about the deity, about the lack of deity of Christ. Well, those same arguments are here today with Jehovah's Witnesses giving us that exact same argument. They've been answered. You know, if we study what was written at that time when Athanasius was arguing with Arius, then we have those same ideas, and our students should be able to recognize those in their modern form. I want to quote, I read this in another talk, so for those of you who are in both of them, I apologize, but it's really a quote worth hearing again. But Mortimer Adler wrote, on any subject being considered, the relation between truth and error is that of one to many. The truth is always singular, while the errors it corrects are manifold. This fact should not be thought of as invidious to the worth of reading the great books. On the contrary, it is of the greatest importance. No truth is well understood until and unless all the errors it corrects are also understood, and all the contradictions found are resolved. It is in the context of a plurality of errors to be corrected and of contradictions to be resolved that the brilliance of the truth shines out and illumines the scene. I share that with you because very often Christian parents worry about using so many non-Christian books, and a lot of these books are not Christian books. Now, a lot of them are, but it's in seeing the ideas and seeing the errors and seeing the comparisons and the contradictions that the truth really does stand up to it. And the truth of God's word will stand any test for that. We need to have the confidence of that through all the ideas are out there, the truth does shine through, and it can stand the test. And it's nice to give the kids confidence to see that as well. So that's a little background on why we do it, but let's talk about the things that are impediments to great books. Number one, intimidation. Intimidation factor. We're afraid we can't read these things ourselves. How are we going to explain them to our kids? When I was in high school, I used to go to the library and get out college textbooks in sciences and bring them home and read them. I had the confidence to tackle that, but I did not have the confidence to tackle Aristotle. It's easier. It really is easier, you know. So Aristotle's Poetics you could read in an afternoon. And so there's this huge intimidation factor that somehow these are going to be too hard and I won't be able to do it. And it's not true. Take a bite, you'll see it goes down. All right. You're not going to get everything the first time through. Nobody does. You know, so the second time through, you'll get more. And so I just say, courage, courage. Okay. It used to be that everybody read these books. Not just the brainiest, not just the smartest, not just the ones going to law school. It's be everybody read these books, and we can do it too. All right. Another impediment is reading skills. We think that we're finished learning how to read in elementary school, but we're really not. And as the mind develops through the logic and the rhetoric years, and as we develop as adults, our ability to read and to reason and to follow an argument grows and develops, and it needs to continue. And that's one of the things that stops us from being able to make sense of some of these more difficult books. I couldn't find my copy, so I don't have it here, but How to Read a Book. There's a book called How to Read a Book by Mortimer Adler. I recommend that. It will help you to dissect an argument, pre-read a book, find the flow of ideas, the organization of the book, all those important things. Stuff you maybe didn't even know. If you just pick up a book and start at the beginning and move through to the end, you're hurting yourself. It's best to go through first and get the organization of the book, understand how it's put together, and then read. But that book goes a great way to teach you. Another source I'd recommend is Reading Between the Lines. This is Jean Edward Veith, Veith, Jr. This is another book that, again, helps you with your reading skills. And it goes through different genres of literature and nonfiction and helps you to understand how they're put together, helps you be a better reader. Also, Leland Ryken, this is another one I don't have with me. He's written a number of books. Realms of Gold, though, is his guide to the Christian classics, and is very worth reading. This is another one, Literature of the Bible, that he's written. It's Ryken. His son is pastor of 10th Pres up in Philadelphia now. He's written a number, literature is his main thing, and he's written a number of great books, but Realms of Gold is a good one to start with. All right, another problem we have in our reading ability is the ability to perceive the worldviews of the authors, where they're coming from, what their presuppositions are. it's very important that as we read these books that we analyze that as we go along. The best book I know for introducing you to worldview differences is The Universe Next Door by James W. Sire. This is a great book for your high school kids, too, for apologetics and philosophy classes. This goes through basic questions. What are the assumptions that an existentialist makes about the existence of God, about the existence of spiritual versus material things, of what's their assumptions about truth? So this very good helps you lead through that. And then he wrote this one, How to Read Slowly, James W. Sire. This book is great for, he sort of applies the same questions that he uses in this book to literature. It helps you get through literature that way. Okay. Another impediment is our ability to read poetically. We live in a very non-poetic age, very dialectic age, and we've kind of lost that ability to see symbol and theme and other poetic elements in literature. And so we can learn, and so we do. And this book I recommend with some hesitancy. So don't give this one to your kids. How to Read Literature Like a Professor, Thomas C. Foster. He's not a Christian, and he gets a little bawdy from time to time. And so, you know, I wouldn't put this in the hands of your kids. And you don't have to read the whole book. You don't have to read it twice, so go borrow it from the library. But you'll get the idea quick. You don't even have to finish the book. You'll get the idea. But it's one of the best, simplest, most straightforward books I've ever read on getting symbolism in literature, what to look for, how to find it, what's it mean. So, you know, with that caveat, I'll recommend that one to you, not your kids. Another great book on reading is How to Read a Poem. And I can't remember the author. It starts with a B. Burton Raffel. There you go. Yeah. Do I have it in my list? Okay. That's another one that is excellent for teaching you really how to understand the form and the structure and all the poetry. So that's a wonderful one. A dictionary of literary symbols. There's lots of them. This is a good one. This one's called Dictionary of Literary Symbols, second edition, Michael Ferber. This one you can look up. A lot of things have meaning. We were watching Wives and Daughters, Elizabeth Gaskell. You know, we were watching the movie, not reading the book, I'll admit. And the second wife is named, what? Hyacinth? Do we know this one? You don't know these? Okay. Anyway, the woman's name is Claire. And then Mr. Gibson proposes to her, and then she reveals that her name is really Hyacinth, and she'd really rather be called Hyacinth. So I'm thinking that must be significant. Well, Claire, what's that mean? You know, light, clarity, whatever. Well, Hyacinth, so I look it up, it has to do with tragedy. And, you know, she turned out not to be the ideal second wife. So, you know, in good literature, these things have meaning. These names have meaning, places have meaning. It means something when they cross over the water, you know, and then when they cross under the water and up, baptism, right? You know, death and rebirth. And there's symbols, and we've lost that in our culture, we've lost the ability to read those symbols, and a lot of the literature that's being produced now doesn't contain it because we've lost a taste for it. But it's there, and it's something that it's a good thing to cultivate in your abilities as you try to read the great books. Another good tool to get over the ability to read poetically hump is a good classical dictionary. I like the old ones. This is called A Smaller Classical Dictionary. It's out of print, but you can buy it. You can find this one at used bookstores. all over. Let me see if they. Blakeney, B-L-A-K-E-N-E-Y. Again, you can look up elements that when they give references, you know this is a reference to some Greek myth or something, and you can't remember what it is, and you don't know the significance of it. You can look it up in a good, the older style. Anyway, classical dictionaries to find that. I do want to warn you, though, when it comes to reading poetically, we have to, because we're just so... We're so tuned against it in our culture. We tend to intellectualize how we're reading poetically too much. And so you don't get too overly analytical. Just let it let that go over on the right side of your brain a little bit. Okay, another impediment is background knowledge. We just don't know these books. We don't know which ones to read. We don't know where to start. And, you know, we're just kind of out there. Okay, there's 64 volumes of this great book. So, you know, where do I start? And there are other great books, and there are other things, especially for the younger children, that ought to be read as well. And, you know, where do we start? So I'll give you a little bit of help on that. One is, this is a good book, Louise Cohen and Oz Guinness, Invitation to the Classics. This is a Christian, Oz Guinness, of course. This goes through background information. It's even got great pictures. But, you know, it's got background information on the books, on the authors, on the times they were written, issues that will come up in the reading, all that you can use. So these are great background. So before you read William Shakespeare's King Lear, you can read about it here and get a little background information. So you're not going in there completely blind. I also use Cliff's Notes for this, that kind of background information. Now, I will not use, though, I will not read the analytical sections where they are interpreting for you. You don't want them to interpret it for you. But to give you background and to give you an idea of some of the themes involved, those can be good background, too. So don't be afraid of those. Also, on the Internet, there are a lot of literature discussion groups. So you can read through people's comments. And some of them are very learned and very, very worth your time reading. Okay. Another impediment is perfectionism. I know sometimes we feel like we have to give them, it has to be perfect. If we're going to mess it up, you know, and I just want to encourage you that if you give them a little bit, you've given them a little bit more than they'd get anywhere else. That every bit helps, and don't. My husband likes to say everything that is worth doing is worth doing poorly, because if it's worth doing, it's worth doing, and it's worth doing the best you can. Enjoy them together. No, you're not going to get it all the first time. No, maybe not the third time, but enjoy it, and don't let perfectionism stop you. That's probably one of the biggest things, thinking I can't do it right, so I'm not going to do it at all. Okay. All right. So adding great books to the curriculum then, some advice there. My first advice is start young. Classic quality children's literature cultivates a taste for the adult stuff. So start early. Nursery rhymes. I'm shocked how many kids don't know their nursery rhymes anymore. You know, that's part of our heritage, too. We need to, you know the nursery rhymes, know the old folk tales and the fairy tales, Aesop's fables. I also share with middle elementary and stuff, we do a lot of reading children's versions of some of the adult. And I know there's debate about that. Some people say, we don't read the abridged one. We read the whole thing. Well, they can't read Homer when they're in third grade, but they can enjoy the stories when they're in third grade. And in Homer's day, they listened to the whole thing, but they also told the stories. You know, so I think it's, my opinion is that it's quite acceptable to do the children's versions of some of these stories early on. That can include things like Siegfried and Song of Roland and Charlemagne and you know, Gawain and the Green Knight and all those. There are children's versions of them, and they like to read them. And it gets them so that it gives them the background. We talked before about trying to tackle these books when you have no background in it and you don't know where to start. Well, it gives them that background so that when they read it, they kind of know what's going to be happening. So I'm all for that. We can also read aloud to them whole works that are above their reading level at the present time. You can get dramatic recordings of a lot of these. We've got a real nice Pilgrim's Progress. It's the whole thing, and it's dramatically read. But you can read aloud to them as well. And just read good stuff. All right, another advice is to facilitate integration within the subject areas. So when you're studying a time in history, you can read the literature of that time. But don't let that rule too much. I think I'm all for that, and I think that integrating subject matter as much as you can is a great thing. I do think sometimes we go so far with that, though, that we're stilted and we can't ever read this book because it doesn't fit in anywhere, you know, with what we're doing. So don't let it rule, but it's a good integration tool. Be sure that you're giving background information before you tackle the works themselves. Either give it yourself or have your student research it, depending on their age. But you should have some background information before you start. Excerpts. That's another debate. Do we read the whole book, or do we just read excerpts? Is it sufficient? I recommend a combination, that by reading excerpts, they can get a taste and a flavor and more genuine familiarity with the work without taking the time to read the whole thing. So you can expand what they're exposed to by using excerpts. On the other hand, they need to make sure they're reading whole works as well. They need to read the whole thing from beginning to end, at least in some of these books. Give the students choices. There are sometimes might be several different books of a certain genre. You want to study the genre. You want to make sure they have that covered, but it doesn't matter so much which particular work. So you can give them some choices there. Another thing I recommend is including some memorization. Memorize poems, speeches, key passages, and have them present that. That gives them an intimate familiarity with it that you wouldn't have otherwise. My son will launch into St. Crispin's Day speech, you know, just bringing something up somewhere around it, and boy, he's ready to go with that. It's something that's very familiar to him, and it's like a personal friend. And so I recommend, at our school, we have a fine arts competition every year where the kids have to memorize and perform, and it's either most of the time it's a poem, sometimes it's a speech, sometimes it's a monologue from Shakespeare or something like that. So include presenting practiced readings. This used to be done, and it's fallen out of the curriculum somehow. If you read the instructions that come in the old readers, like the Baldwin's reader and all that, they'll tell you to practice this until you can do it really well and then do it for your teacher. Hey, but practicing reading so they read very well with very good expression so that it can be read aloud. It's a good thing. Okay, journaling and collecting quotes. So collect, quotes from the passages that they're reading. Some kids turn into really obsessive quote collectors, and that's a neat thing. All right, participate in discussion. There's a Great Books Foundation. You can find them on the web. And in their Junior Great Books program, they talk about something called shared inquiry. And this is a method of leading discussion, and it's interpretive literature discussion. And it teaches you how to ask the right kinds of questions. You can ask factual questions and, what was the name of Sherlock's dog, factual questions. But then there's interpretive questions. What's motivating the characters? why things were done a certain way, why the author included this or that, that kind of thing. And the shared inquiry, we've had all our teachers trained in this. We had a trainer come in and do a two-day session with us. And it's made a tremendous difference in the way discussions go in the classroom, especially in upper school, but even in grammar school. So that is worth looking at. You can find on the web some instructions on how to do that, how to ask those questions. Include written response to literature in the curriculum. Now, in the grammar school, that can look like summarizing, where they have to summarize what happened, or they can do a character sketch. When you're getting up into logic school, you're talking more about the plot, how things work together, elements of the plot. By the time you're in rhetoric school, they should be able to discuss theme. They should be able to compare how theme is handled in two different works and compare them together and come to conclusions based on that. Like, what are the authors, these two authors, what's their view of redemption? You know, how is it different in these two works? That sort of thing. So as you go up, that gets more and more sophisticated, but having written responses is critical, I think, very important to the curriculum. Syntopical reading. By that I mean you look for the same idea or same answer, the same question by reading different works and comparing them. I'm gonna talk a little bit more about this great book set in, let's see. The first two volumes, and this is to me what makes this set so valuable. The first two volumes of this great book set is called the Syntopicon, which I believe is a word that Mortimer Adler made up. But and it's a new kind of reference book. It was new then, 50s. You can look up an idea in here. There's 102, I think, ideas. Why he didn't stop at 100, I don't know. But this book will trace the same idea. Okay, this one's Custom and Convention. First, there's an essay that traces these ideas throughout the great books. And then, the most valuable part of this, it breaks this idea down into an outline, all different aspects of that idea, and it tells you who discusses it when. So you can find out, all right, if you want to talk about the conflict of customs, their variation from place to place, you can read about that in Euripides, Herodotus, Plato, Hippocrates, Virgil, Plutarch, Tacitus, Chaucer, Montaigne, Descartes, Pascal, Hume, Swift. Okay, it goes all the way up to Dostoevsky. You know, who talks about it where, what page number it's on in the set. This is useless if you don't have the set because the page number's on, so they know what they're doing. But so this is called a Syntopicon, Syntopican. So that is a very valuable resource for that kind of thinking, for a rhetoric level, pulling together ideas and then synthesizing those ideas with their own ideas, coming to their own conclusions, doing something new with it. Okay.
I've lost track when the, since I'm new to this, what age roughly the rhetoric stage starts?
Oh, okay. Rhetoric, I'd say around ninth grade.
Ninth grade.
Yeah.
So just if you don't mind, as you're talking, if you could put these ideas and references of what age is.
Okay.
You know, one of the big questions I have is, you know, when do I, you know, go from the Hardy Boys to, you know, play.
All right. Let me make a little chart because I'm really almost finished with what I have anyway. So this will give me something else to do. All right. Think about pre-poly. Okay, pre-poly is really K to 2. At this stage, you're focusing on phonics, basic math. You want them to get the words off the page. But in the meantime, you're really doing more reading. The reading that they're doing is not going to be the best quality reading. But you want to be making sure they're hearing it, that they're hearing. So your fairy tales, your Mother Goose, nursery rhymes, all that great stuff needs to come in there. Then you've got grammar. And every kid's different, but say 3 to 6. Now they're ready for Aesop. They're ready for them. Am I too far away from this mic? Sorry. Okay. They're ready for the more complicated fairy tales and folk tales. You know, one of the outgrowths of new ideas about multiculturalism is that there's lots of folk tales from all over the world coming out in beautiful books for children, which are bringing back these old stories from all over the world, and it's just wonderful for us to be able to have access to those. A lot of those are appropriate during this age. As you get to further up toward the end of that stage, they can start with a Hobbit and Tolkien and all those other things that are beautiful, based on a lot of the old folk tales. And, okay, then you've got your logic or your dialectic, it's called, or pert stage. It's officially 7 to 8 in our school. I think it really goes into 9 a little bit too. We teach formal logic at this stage, and this is when they're ready to do much more analysis in their books. Then we've got rhetoric, is your 9 to 12. Now, I see a marked difference between the 9th and 10th graders and the 11th and 12th graders as far as their ability. I think those are really developmental years. And their ability to do the kind of syntopical reading and all that I was speaking of, really 11, 12 for the most part. They're starting it. We're trying earlier, but it's a little like pulling teeth at first. But once they get up to 11th and 12th grade, they seem to really be able to soar with it, and they're very energized by it. So that'll help with that. You know, I can't tell you what books to do when. And, you know, if you came here hoping for that, I'm sorry. But there's just so much out there. There's so much to choose from. And there's a lot of reading guides and things out there that you can use and give you some ideas to choose from. But really what's more important is that you are choosing from among the great books and that you're getting to know some of them really well. And you don't need to know all of them really well. And you don't need to know all of them a little bit, but it helps to know at least a few of them really well in order to gain the confidence then to be a lifelong learner. Then your students go on and they say, oh, I can do this. You know, we got through, my son and I got through Poetics at home, Aristotle's Poetics, and he said, well, I think I'll read Politics. And he did that on his own. So because he had experience with the one, it gave him the confidence to say, okay, then I can do this other, and I can read these books, and I can get a lot out of them. And they're wonderful, and they're rich, and they discover how great they are. But if you're cramming them down, got to get through all the books in the list, and you got to get them all done, and it's not going to be enjoyable. It's not going to be the delight that it was meant to be. And so it's you're not going to leave them with that desire to read more. You want to leave them hungry, not famished, not defeated, you know, because it's so much.
So I know, like you're saying, every kid's different. You can't say, you know, exactly what book at what age. But just for instance, you mentioned your son reading Aristotle.
Mm-hmm.
How old is he roughly?
I think we did that in 9th grade. Mm-hmm. So, but Poetics is easy. It's not like reading Aristotle's Logic, which I'm plowing through right now. It's a fairly easy book to read.
So. I guess that it would be probably a good first step, as you said, to you can go on the web and just find out what classic books they have in children's versions. And would it be fair to say that, you know, at the grammar level, you can start to introduce those, you know, based on your
right
judgment of your child and the book itself? But,
right, and tying it in with other things you're reading. If you follow, we use the Veritas History at our school, you know, it's kind of breaks the history down by time period over the course of from 2nd grade to 6th. And we'll introduce those and where it fits in with that history. So the third graders are doing Greece and Rome. They read a children's Homer. They read Aesop's Fables. And they do, and they use Aesop's Fables in their writing. Then they'll do imitation and writing exercises using Aesop's Fables. So they really get to know those pretty well. And the Homer gives them the plot line so that later when they're reading the thing in its lyric poetry form and seems so overwhelmed, they know the story. They know what's happening. So it helps them a lot.
Yeah. I remember coming across Hillsdale College, Conservative College in Michigan. They have a school up there, and they have a reading list, and I think they do all the classics. So you can print that off the web, and you can look, kindergarten, and there are a ton of books, and pick from that list if that's what you're looking for, something a little easier,
right.
Just to say, here's a list, and pick whatever ones you want.
You know what else does it? Douglas Wilson has a little book, Classical Christian Homeschool or something, and he's got an extensive list in there. What I'll do, I'll tell you what, I'll put my email up here. If you email me, I'll send you the reading list from our school, from our curriculum guides. It'll be what's covered in every grade. Now, when things are on that list, it might be that they're being read to them. It might be that they're reading them. So especially in the younger grades. Yeah.
I know that, like, with our curriculum, we read The Sign of the Beagle. Well, one of the stories is the Matt is trying to teach a teen how to read, and he's using Robinson Crusoe. So my first year at our school, I read them Robinson Crusoe. Okay, well, that's what they would have never survived that on their own.
Right.
But I think if you read to them something that is above their level and you read it dramatically, even mm-hmm. though they may not have understood everything, it gave more opportunities, and they're at least hearing the vocabulary and getting it in their head. And later on, they made connections to something totally different that we were talking about in history. They're like, oh, Miss O'Shaughnessy, that was what we learned back with Robinson Crusoe.
Right. And if you, the library has got a lot of, we did Robinson Crusoe on audio tape with my family. Yeah. And so in the car, we had a long commute. And so those are very valuable for that too, and they really do. They'll get the gist, they'll get the idea of it.
You can like skip over some of it. See, I was afraid to skip over the part, because there was some of it that was very repetitive, and it's okay to skip over some of that. You know where he was, making the goat skin floating on in great detail. You could kind of skip over some.
Yeah, they can get a little dry in parts. It speaks to the monotony of his situation, though, doesn't it? I always thought the monotony of that writing was for that purpose.
I saw a book, I thought you had it up there, but a good introduction, which I just got done reading, is The Well-Trained Mind by Wise Bauer.
Yes.
It gives not only lists of books for each grade, but it also does a very good job of explaining what is grammar and what should you do in grammar stage and what is logic and what you do.
Yeah. Those are good lists to use. I just my caution is that don't feel like you have to do everything on that list or that you can't do it at a different grade or that take their suggestions. And don't feel bound to them. I've just seen so many people just trying to get through this list and don't do that. Take them at a good pace. This is another one I didn't hold up, but what is The Western Canon by Harold Bloom. This is another one that will give you background, a lot of background information on different writers.
Yeah, I heard a phrase before, but I've never heard any meaning behind it, and I didn't know if it was something made up or it was something that existed. And it was the term junior great books.
The Great Books Foundation has a junior great books program. And that it makes use of the shared inquiry method. They actually have curriculum materials. They're not Christian, and they're not a Christian book group per se, but you're not going to find it antagonistic. They have readers on all the different levels. They take really great authors and then folk tales from around the world in these. And the stories, they're like little anthology books. They're like readers you would use, the old Basel readers we used to have. but they're full of, it's good stuff. And there's teacher's guides that go with them with information, with how to do lessons and how to do shared inquiry discussions with them. And they're pretty good. We use them as a supplement in our school. So every grade's got one. And in the upper grades, they have a lot of good information, good collections, like there's one that's all on liberty, and so you have all different kinds of writings around that theme of liberty, and so you'll read Locke and, you know, Rousseau, and, you know, so that it ties all those things together. So they're a good resource. Just find them on the web. I think it's just greatbooks.com. But, you know, they're tied in with a publication of these, and it's a group that Adler and his group started. Yeah. Let me see if I got any more here. This is a good one. Richard Pratt. Do you know, you might know the book Every Thought Captive, which is a great apologetics book for high school kids. But this one, God Gave Us Stories. This is like a hermeneutic of Old Testament narrative. It teaches you how to interpret it and how to understand. But it's applicable to a lot of other kinds of books as well. So that's another good one. Oh, this book. This book I love. I haven't gotten through yet. I'll look at it. But this is called The Great Tradition. And these are classic readings on what it means to be an educated human being, edited by Richard M. Gamble, G-A-M-B-L-E. This is published by ISI, Intercollegiate Scholastic Institute, which we're blessed in, and their main office is right down the road from our school, and they bring in these great speakers, the authors of these books, and they come in. But this one is essays and excerpts and things on education, and it starts with Plato, and it goes through, you know, Erasmus and Martin Luther and C.S. Lewis and, you know, all the way up to the current times. And it's just, if you want to understand how education has been thought of through the centuries and how it's changed and what it's become, this is a great book that has it all in one place. Okay, do we have any more questions? Yeah. Okay.
I have a 3-year-old, so I have time as far as
Mother Goose, right?
We got that. As far as all of this, I felt like I had, you know, good Christian education in school. We didn't read this kind of stuff.
No.
And when you started with your son, I mean, were you pretty much?
We read them together. I still am new to the game.
Okay. I mean, you sound incredibly knowledgeable now and comfortable. And
then I'm.
Years.
Two baby steps ahead of you, okay?
Okay. So, and even now, just get started, right?
Right.
With me, on my own.
We didn't read this, and that's the reality of classical Christian education, is that we're trying to give something to our kids that we didn't have. You know, we didn't get it. I wasn't educated this way. You know, most of us weren't. Some few blessed members of our generation were, but not that many. And we're trying to give them something we didn't have. They didn't, and they're not going to have it all either. And we just need to admit that up front. They're not going to have the same classical education that Jonathan Edwards had, because there's no one alive capable of giving it to them. Okay, so we've got to build, and we just need to start walking. And the people that to our ears sound so knowledgeable and so educated would sound like dolts in, you know, in another generation, a few generations ago. And so we just have to humbly pick up where we are and read some of these books together. You know, the first time I read Poetics was when my son and I read it together. And so, and just trust that God will bless what we, you know, what we endeavor to do. Anything else?
I had just
okay.
Kind of added that we do God for them. And so it's kind of a cheating way to be able to get the great books, because the book list is there and we do it. We have tutors who are knowledgeable about it and teach it, mm-hmm. like Dory does. But one thing that I've always done with my children, I have a 16-year-old, an 11-year-old, and a 9-year-old. And you were talking about reading aloud. I have read aloud when my 16-year-old, who is a senior this year, when he was reading Beowulf, my youngest, Jesse, who is 9, at the time was probably 3 or 4, and we read in the car. Anytime we go anywhere, on any trips, we've got books and we do all of our reading. And so he was exposed to Beowulf. But I do think the reading aloud is, you were talking about reading poetics. The first time I ever read Beowulf was with my son, to my children. And it's so, because we didn't have that opportunity, because I didn't read, we had little read, you know, we had short stories that we read mm-hmm. when I was in school. And mm-hmm. so instead of feeling overwhelmed, because I was where you guys are, probably 7 years ago, sitting there going, great books, and I didn't read any of these, read them with your children.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, you know, you learn right along with them, and you get things out of it that they can't get yet. That's okay.
There's something very valuable about reading aloud anyway. I really think it adds something to the reading. A lot of the what I would categorize as great books that my son and I read together in homeschool, we read out loud, taking turns reading to each other, because you hear the beauty of the language much more so in that case than you do. Of course, a lot of these you're reading in translation, and some of that's lost, but especially ones that were written in English and you're reading in English, to read it out loud is really beneficial. Yes?
What is your opinion, if you're allowed to give it, of the omnibus curriculum?
You know, I'm not familiar with it. Our school had, by the time that was published, we had kind of developed our own. And so for that reason, we're not using that. I think probably our program is very similar, but it's what we did. So I can't give you a recommendation either way. Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry. I know a lot of people are using it and very happy with it. And I'm just not personally familiar with it. Sorry about that. Okay, I think we're done then. You're quite welcome. I let you out early.